For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, with another readout video from our free Wednesday Wake Up email newsletter and another request to subscribe to and support our work if you don't already. You know, I was saying the other day that I really don't like asking for money, but somebody responded and said, look, we know you realize that a lot of people are doing what they can and that times are tough. We know you're talking to the people who maybe can afford to give a little bit more. So we very much appreciate everyone who gives. Large contributions or small, it all helps us get the work done, including the people who are using the YouTube thanks button. And we also have a salut les gars to viewers in France, which is another place I really have been to more than once, and who've made it 15 on our list of all-time views by jurisdiction. Followed by a return to Canada and the toxic attempt by our government to orient our economy around climate competitiveness, which is producing neither. After weeks of leaks and teasing about an imminent deal between the Canadian federal government and the Alberta provincial one under Danielle Smith, we were given a solid result. Quote, go time! Danielle Smith and Mark Carney agree to a pipeline deal, end quote. Yay! Oh, wait. We promptly got fog, not steel tubing. Quote, Prime Minister Mark Carney and Alberta Premier Danielle Smith have agreed to the broad outlines of a memorandum of understanding, end quote. And then even the fog blew away, with the Prime Minister announcing patronizingly in question period that this achievement he touted should not be mistaken for an achievement because it, quote, creates necessary but not sufficient conditions, end quote, for a pipeline. Meaning we not only have to entice back all the investors scared off by 10 years of activist and government obstacles, but also try to get consent through some undefined process from some undefined set of people who hate pipelines, jack up Alberta's industrial carbon price, and load on costly new carbon capture requirements, and then somehow expand production while remaining committed, we know not how, to net zero. Before the energy sector had limped along even one single victory lap, the Green Left had begun chortling that for them, this deal is more lifeline than pipeline. In the newsletter, we also noted that, once again, the arrival of winter had taken all the clever people by surprise. The Canadian press informs us that, quote, blasts of frigid Arctic air could send temperatures tumbling in December and herald the arrival of a more traditional Canadian winter, a meteorologist for the Weather Network predicts as it releases its seasonal outlook, end quote. And Heat Map Daily emails, with no apparent embarrassment given their own advocacy on the subject, and still no ability to post their newsletters so we can link to them, that, quote, winter is going to be a problem, end quote, because, quote, chestnuts may soon be roasting on an open fire, but more homes are being heated by heat pumps. Grid planners and policymakers have to adjust to the possibility that they will soon face peak demand in the winter, especially in cold and dark regions like New England. Their challenge? How to meet the increased demand from decarbonized home heat with decarbonized energy generation, end quote. Yep. If only they'd listened to those bourgeois sticks in the mud who warned about going all in on alternative energy while waging war on the stuff that works, instead of relying on endless rhetoric about how alternatives were fast becoming cheaper and more reliable, and anyway, winter was history. Not that the quality of debate in the modern world is disintegrating, but scientific paranoia runs a piece, quote, the fossil fuel industry has a plan to drown Earth in plastic, end quote. Not, oh dear, there's a downside to this wonderful material. Heck no. Instead, quote, to keep profits rolling in, oil and gas companies want to turn fossil fuels into a mounting pile of packaging and other plastic products, end quote. Boo packaging, boo companies, boo profits. But be assured, their climate reporting is just as sensible. Oh, wait. This is their climate reporting. See, quote, as the looming dangers of climate change are pushing the world away from fossil fuels, the industry is betting on plastic to protect its profitability, end quote. Now, as we noted last week, the world is not being pushed away from fossil fuels. Peak oil is a mirage, and oil, gas, and coal still provide most of humanity's power and will for the foreseeable future. But something may well be pushing the world away from Scientific American, namely its plan to drown science coverage in activism. And another thing, satire cannot keep up with the media advisory that, quote, Talib Nur Muhammad, parliamentary secretary to the Minister of Artificial Intelligence and Digital Innovation, end quote, and yes, that really is a job, or at least a job description in Canada's federal cabinet, quote, will highlight new ocean technology projects that are driving sustainable transformation in the ocean economy, end quote. Of course, it manages to have a land acknowledgement, even with regard to water. And yes, his boss, the Prime Minister, loves transformative leverage and catalyze, but the latter only with an S, as he loves the present tense to describe implausible aspirations, not actual achievements. But isn't there something a bit demeaning in pretending that such sentences refer to anything real? In the ocean economy and supported by Canada's ocean supercluster? What? Then, from the It Does Not Mean What You Think It Means file, Canary Media, whose coverage of the inevitable, inexorable, massive green energy transition increasingly involves hopeful monster startups, not things working at all, let alone at scale, chirps that, quote, happy day before Thanksgiving. Our holiday travel takes us to Connecticut, where a unique model is making solar development happen, Jeff St. John reports. There, the state-run Green Bank has become a developer and even owner of solar projects on public buildings like schools and low-income housing, end quote. But the fact that state-run institutions are pouring other people's money into trendy technologies does not prove that they're succeeding in the real economy. Indeed, almost inevitably, it means they aren't and won't. Then, from the Evacuate in Our Moment of Triumph file, Bloomberg Green chortles that, quote, New York City controller Brad Lander is urging three of the city's pension funds to drop BlackRock because of inadequate climate plans, the latest move to penalize investment firms for failing to tackle global warming, end quote. Say, would that be the same New York City that, along with the entire state of New York, is about to hit that green wall as its alternative energy fantasies collide with reality? And also that faces a conventional budget catastrophe? Great time to depress pension returns, guys and gals. A surefire political and economic winner, that one is. Ah, and in the newsletter, we also admitted that we just can't leave COP30 behind. At least, not without an award. Yes, folks, Canada left with renewed ambition, renewed verbiage, and the Fossil of the Day Award. Which goes to those governments, quote, doing the most to achieve the least, end quote. Ah, shucks. But as the Climate Action Network emailed, quote, Canada's inaction at this COP and significant climate backsliding at home has drawn the attention of our members, allies, and media, end quote. So much for that triumph. Meanwhile, on the real planet Earth, not Earth COP 30, we continue to watch with some encouraged amusement as some of the world's deep thinkers start realizing that humanity has worse problems than it getting very marginally less chilly on a planet whose current temperature is way below the average for pre-industrial times. For instance, Bill Gates somehow just realizing that malaria is worse than warmth. And in that vein, we note with relief rather than pleasure a Reuters Sustainable Switch email on, quote, toxic waters in Southeast Asia and Jamaica, end quote. We're against toxic waters, of course, but precisely because we're against them, and they're a real, serious, fixable problem, we're glad that they're paying attention to something other than the climate scare. Especially as, and perhaps you guessed, the toxic mines that are poisoning rivers and people in Southeast Asia, there are over 2,000 of them and they're pumping out stuff like cyanide and mercury, they're in many cases Chinese financed and controlled to extract raw materials, especially rare earths, that help the communists dominate the dirty new green technology and, they hope, the world economy. The Economist may gush that, quote, a more surprising ingredient of China's success is its nimble and permissive regulators, end quote, but there is a downside to those nimble regulators, and it's their permissiveness. And if you think Chinese firms are subjected to shareholder activism about the greenness of their foreign operations and so forth, remember, all Chinese firms are, by law, obliged to obey the Chinese government, so it's the shareholder, and it's villainous, and it lies a lot. By the way, if we seem obsessed with COPs generally and COP 30 in particular, it's not just our CDO. That's OCD, but with the letters in alphabetical order, as they should be. It's because the climate zealots are obsessed with them, which makes their commentary on those conferences a bellwether for whether they're smartening up about the weather. Including Heat Map trying to celebrate that, quote, for the second year in a row, the United Nations Climate Conference ended without a consensus declaration that tackling global warming requires transitioning away from fossil fuels. The final agreement at COP30 did, however, touch on another uncomfortable subject. Countries resolved to limit the magnitude and duration of any temperature overshoot, end quote. Right. resolved being a word here, meaning they've admitted they can't do what they said was easy, so they promised to do something harder, but not yet. And that's a triumph. In the newsletter, we also presented the second installment in our deep dive into this summer's Red Team Report on Climate for the United States Department of Energy. This one looks at Chapter 3, which is on the indirect effects of CO2, particularly Chapter 3.1 on radiative forcing. The research team started by noting the climate has changed all through Earth's history, and it's driven by factors like ocean cycles, orbital changes, solar variations, volcanoes, and a lot more. Gosh, really? Then they say that humans are changing the composition of the atmosphere by emitting CO2 and by emitting aerosols, which can change the balance of energy coming in from the sun and going out through radiation at the top of the atmosphere. That's what the IPCC calls radiative forcing. And the DOE report presents the numbers as they're shown in IPCC reports. But they also point out something that often goes unmentioned, which is that these alleged changes in radiative forcing due to greenhouse gases are so small that they're below the measurement limits of modern satellites. So, we've been given error bars as proof positive, which is not how science works. And it gets worse, because another study shows that the Earth is getting better at dissipating heat, which throws off all those calculations. At least that's our take on a new study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, with a hat tip to No Tricks Zone. Now, the authors of the study don't put it that way, but it seems to follow because they start with a very simple statement of the Earth's energy budget, N equals F plus R. And for a long time, N, that's the net change, moved in lockstep with F, that's the force in the extra trapped heat, so R, the stuff getting radiated out, was constant. Now, all of this is models and proxies, so caveat emptor. But the best guesswork says that since 2000, N and F have been diverging, which means the Earth is pumping out more heat. And the punchline is, nobody knows why, because climate is very complicated, despite what people tell you about how simple it all is. Oh, and the other punchline is, it means that a lot of climate models show too much warming. Though arguably, to their creators and defenders, that's a feature, not a bug. Finally, from the funny plant names file and the co2science.org archive, the Knobby Club sounds like a hangout for snooty English gentlemen straight out of a P.G. Wodehouse farce, and the Knobby Club rush would presumably be either its initiation rite or a hasty eviction from its premises. Meanwhile, its Latin name, Ficinia nodosa L, sounds like the sort of visitor Jeeves would announce, only to have Bertie Wooster panic and blurt out, "Jeeves, I am not at home. Say I've emigrated or died or something," end quote. But as a matter of fact, Knobby Club Rush is not English. It's native to Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. And it is not a woman. It's a tall perennial able to grow in sandy soil and gardens alike, which makes it popular with landscapers. And it loves CO2. In 2020, a pair of experiments showed an extra 300 parts per million of CO2 caused it to grow an average of 275% bigger. So if you see Ficinia nodosa coming toward you on an Australian beach, she may be taller than you expected. For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, and I know a memorandum of misunderstanding when I see one.